Welcome, friends. How's the sound? Is this good? Can you hear me? All right. Two thumbs up. Okay. So, continuing on our journey, we're going to move into another story of a Buddha's attendant called Meghiya. So this is the Meghiya Sutta. And it starts, as most of the suttas do, "Thus have I heard. At one time the Buddha was staying at Chalika on Chalika Hill. At that time, the Venerable Meghiya was the Buddha's attendant." Now, during this time, it's much later than what Eliza was reflecting on, the turning of the wheel. That was at the beginning. This is now, that was when Ananda, you know, initially Ananda was the Buddha's attendant, and now the Buddha is having other attendants, and this time Meghiya is his attendant. So at this point, the Buddha's dispensation is fully established. There's a bhikkhu sangha, bhikkhunis, there's lay women, lay men, the fourfold sangha that the Buddha had wanted to cultivate has been cultivated, and there are arhants in all those categories, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen. And if you wanted to know more about the bhikkhunis, I think some people had wondered about that. Where are the women? there's the bhikkhuni samyutta in this collection, the Samyutta Nikaya. There's also the Theragata, which is a collection of poems from the first Buddhist nuns. So that would be another two good resources to reflect on, to read and reflect on. Okay, so that's sort of a sense of where we're at in the Buddha's time. Okay, so we've got Venerable Meghiya approached the Buddha, bowed down to him, stood to one side and said, "I wish to go into Jhantu village for alms food, revered sir." And the Buddha replies, "Do now, Meghiya, what you think it is time to do." And then the Venerable Meghiya, having put on his robe in the morning and taken his bowl and outer cloak, entered Jhantu village for alms food. Having walked in Jhantu village for alms food, after the meal on returning, he approached the bank of the river Kimikala. As he was walking up and down beside the river for exercise, he saw a pleasant and charming mango grove. On seeing it, he thought, "This mango grove is very pleasant and charming." Indeed. It is eminently suitable for the exertion and meditation of a young person of good family who is intent on meditation. If the Buddha were to give me permission, I would come and exert myself in meditation in this mango grove. So that sounds like a good aspiration, huh? Mm-hmm. Young monk wants to put in some effort to practice. Then the Venerable Meghiya approached the Buddha, bowed down, sat to one side and said, "Revered sir, having put on my robe in the morning, I approached the bank of the river Kimikala and saw a pleasant and charming mango grove. On seeing this, I thought, 'This mango grove is very pleasant and charming.' It is eminently suitable for the exertion and meditation of a young person of good family who is intent on meditation. If the Buddha were to give me permission, I would come and exert myself in meditation in this mango grove. If, revered sir, you give me permission, I would go to that mango grove to exert myself in meditation." When this was said, the Buddha replied to the Venerable Meghiya, "As we are alone, Meghiya, wait a while until some other attendant comes." So the Buddha is basically saying it's just you and me right now, and you know it's a good aspiration to have, but wait until someone else comes to take your place as my attendant. But a second time, the Venerable Meghiya said to the Buddha, "Revered sir, the Buddha has nothing further that should be done. and nothing to add to what has been done. Yeah? I can't even imagine this. The Buddha, ocean-like compassion, and this young monk is saying, yo, you've achieved the goal. I haven't, you know? So, anyway. Yeah, pretty amazing. So, but for me, reverts, there is something further that should be done and something to add to what has been done. If, revered sir, you give me permission, I would go to that mango grove to exert myself in meditation. A second time, the Buddha replied to Venerable Meghiya, as we are alone, Meghiya, wait a while until some other attendant comes. And then a third time, the Venerable Meghiya said to the Buddha, revered sir, the Buddha has nothing further that should be done. I would go to that mango grove to exert myself in meditation. So, as is done, if the Buddha is asked three times, he gives permission. So he says, as you are talking of exertion and meditation, Meghiya, what can I say? Do now, Meghiya, what you think it is time to do. So then the Venerable Meghiya rose from his seat and bowed to the Buddha, and keeping his right side to him, went to the mango grove. And on entering that mango grove, he sat down at the foot of a certain tree. So I just want to again bring to light that, you know, we recently had a talk, I think it might have been yesterday, with Bahia, who traveled like 1,200 miles to meet the Buddha, you know, to get a teaching. I mean, he just was so intent on meeting the Buddha and to get a teaching, and he got that wonderful teaching of, in this scene, there's just a scene, etc. And then he gets killed by a cow, you know. So, and then here we have Meghiya, who's like, just like not really taking his responsibilities with the Buddha and not even acknowledging that he's with the Buddha. And instead just saying, hey, I've got to do this. And he's, you know, removing himself from the Buddha despite the Buddha's attempt at, you know, directing him otherwise. So, So now, while the Venerable Meghiya was staying in the mango grove, there kept occurring to him three bad, unwholesome kinds of thoughts, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of doing harm. The Venerable Meghiya then reflected, it is indeed strange, it is indeed remarkable. Although I have gone forth out of faith from home to homelessness, I am overwhelmed by these three bad, unwholesome kinds of thoughts. Sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of doing harm. Then the Venerable Meghiya, on emerging from seclusion in the late afternoon, approached the Buddha, prostrated himself, sat down to one side, and said, revered sir, while I was staying in that mango grove, there kept occurring in me three bad, unwholesome kinds of thoughts, and I thought, it is indeed strange. I am overwhelmed by these three bad, unwholesome kinds of thoughts, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of doing harm. So this reminded me of a retreat I was on back in the 80s, and some of you were on it. One was, I think Margaret was, back in the 80s, when we had these old cars that you held up the hatchback with a stick. Just, you know, it's amazing. Duct tape the cars together to get to the retreats. Anyway, we were on this retreat. It was with Jack Hornfield and at maybe Angela Center or Santa Sabina in San Rafael. And there was somebody in front of me that was twitching, and I was having a hard time settling into the retreat. So I had an interview with Jack, and he asked me how it was going, and I said, you know, I can't settle. There's somebody in front of me twitching, and I can't. And he said, so move. And I said, okay, I'll move, you know. And so I did, and guess what? You know, the restlessness still continued. We had nothing to do with the person. There was restlessness, and this mind was landing on it and just projecting it out on someone else. So, yeah, I've got a number of stories like that. Yeah. I'll tell you one more. Just got time. I would go to Chidhurst Monastery where Willa has, where I met Willa actually. Had a wonderful first meeting with her, and when she was a nun there, and I missed Eliza. She was away when I was there that time. So, but Chidhurst is a very, very unusual place. I mean, I think that most monasteries in this tradition, the ones that I've been to, they're amazing, the people that are attracted to these places. And how it works is quite amazing, how these monasteries work. So in Chidhurst, and in all these monasteries, in all these monasteries, lay people come together to work in the kitchen, you know, to make a meal. And so so we have normally about 2 hours to get a meal together for about 40 people in the community. And we, at that time, we used what was in the larder. And sometimes there was just cabbage and chickpeas in the larder. And then, okay, so that's one thing. I mean, some things like onions and other things, but sometimes it could be pretty lean, as well it will attest to, I think. And not only that, but you have people who have varying degrees of culinary skills. Wide variety. Some think they're, you know, Julia Child, you know, and they're like, why are you head cook when I'm, you know, great? And then some don't know anything, you know, like what's a whisk? I don't know what a whisk is. So we've got these people trying to make a meal, and somehow we managed to do this. You know, we managed to get the meal out, and then you know, there's, you know, we're rubbing up against each other, and there's, you know, there's sometimes there's tension, and then we sit together, and sometimes we sit together till like 3 a.m. So it's just such a strange way of being with people, in that, you know, we do this intense work together, and then we all sit knee to knee and practice, supporting each other. So, and one time, I was just getting into this sense of a gathered mind. It was just starting to feel into the sense of that sense that Willa talks about of the bell. And there was this woman who, it seemed like whenever I would just kind of settle into this calm state, just kind of getting, she'd start coughing really loudly, really loudly. And I'm not saying that coughing is bad or wrong, so please do not feel like you have to leave the hall to cough or anything. But this was ongoing, and I would be jolted out of it, and then there's righteous indignation would come up, and I'd settle again, and there'd be a coughing, and then I'd be like, why didn't you just step out? And it would get into irritation, and, you know, on and on. So I was there for 3 months, and this went on for about 2, at least. At least, you know. A lot of dukkha. Until finally, out of just necessity, out of desperation maybe, I just turned the attention to the coughing. And then it just opened things up, and things settled. Yeah. So I can relate to Meghia. You know, it's like, you know, you think you're going to be doing something, you think it's going to be for your well-being, and it isn't. You know, and you learn something from it. So it's not just like you're a bad meditator, you're no good, blah 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 blah. All the self-criticism. It's that, you know, okay. Ajahn Suchitto calls it navigation error, you know, oops, you know, let's incline the mind in a different way, let's learn from it. Okay, so moving on to the story. So Meghia comes back, talks to the Buddha and says, you know, I was overwhelmed by these 3 bad, unwholesome kinds of thoughts, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of doing harm. And then the Buddha says, when mind deliverance is still immature, Meghia, 5 things lead to maturity. Now, he could say, Meghia, you know, I told you to stay with me, you know? But instead, he gives him a teaching, which, again, just really inspires me. So he says, here, Meghia, a practitioner has good friends, good associates, good companions. When mind deliverance is still immature, Meghia, this is the first thing that leads to its maturity. Furthermore, Meghia, a practitioner is virtuous or has an ethical standard. They live restrained by the restraint of their discipline, endowed with good conduct and appropriate resort, seeing danger in the smallest faults. They train the training rules they have accepted. When mind deliverance is still immature, Meghia, this is the second thing that leads to its maturity. So, I think that the emphasis here that I would put on it is that we train in the training rules or standards that we've accepted. There's this two Pali words, hiri and otapa, which I guess could be translated as conscience and concern. And I think it was Ajahn Chah who went to his teacher when he felt like he couldn't keep all the training rules. And I think that his teacher said, just keep this standard of hiri otapa, yeah, and you'll do okay. Just keep the standard of being conscious, of conscience and concern for maintaining the discipline, in a sense. And so our standard is not a monastic standard, and it varies probably among us what we how we choose to conduct ourselves in that ethical realm. And I'm sure there's obviously things that we agree on, right? Not doing harm, not taking what's not given, practicing with speech. I mean, this is such an important part, speech towards self, towards others, respecting other people's boundaries and commitments. And how do we manage intoxicants? That's something that we navigate. So the Buddha's talking about ethics. They live restrained by the restraint of their discipline. And this is the second thing that leads to its maturity. And further, Meghia, a practitioner obtains at will, with no trouble or difficulty, talk that is effacing, a help in opening up the mind, and which conduces to complete turning away, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. That is, talk about fewness of wishes, talk about contentment, talk about seclusion, about non-entanglement, about putting forth energy, about virtue, about collectedness of mind and wisdom, about deliverance, talk about the knowledge and vision of deliverance. When mind deliverance is still immature, Meghia, this is the third thing that leads to its maturity. So talking with Dhamma friends, really, that in a supportive way to help us continue this cultivation. And there was one point in this journey of mine in practice where I had lived at a Zen monastery for 4 years. I then immediately went in and studied and practiced and worked with Thich Nhat Hanh and his publishing company for about 16 years, and then went to school, to acupuncture school. And at that time, I wasn't practicing. And there was one moment, maybe 3 years in school, where I was sitting at night with my partner watching Jeopardy. And I thought, is this what my life has become? It was just like, where's Dhamma? Where'd it go? And it was really something. It was sobering. So I went on a retreat. A monk was visiting Portland, and I went on that retreat, and then I asked him if I could go to a Bayagiri in at Christmas time when the place was packed, you know, and he said yes. You know, this is the type of thing that happens in this tradition. And there was no, there wasn't room for me when he said yes, but there, they found, I mean, he, I stayed in this hut that just happened, that was, I shared with somebody. And then there was a friend down there, Methika, and I asked her if, because my practice felt like it was hanging on a thread, by a thread, you know. So I asked her, you know, can we start, can we talk daily? Can we read, Tanisaro has these book meditations. I'm sure many of you have seen those, multiple volumes of them. Can we read one, I forget if it was a day or one for a week, and contemplate it, and, you know, and just keep adding kindling to the fire, you know, really. So, and she said yes. And we did. And that got this being back in the stream again of practice. So, you know, one thing I notice about this group of people that come to things like this is that we're very willing to be available for one another, and that sometimes it just means we ask, you know, hey, you know, can we stay in touch? I've, you know, Skyped with people to sit together, you know. There's so many ways that we can come together now with the internet. So, and I just encourage, I encourage you all to do that, to do whatever you need to feel you can practice that upright way of being in body and mind that Willa mentions. Okay. And then moving on, Maggie, a practitioner, lives with energy aroused for the abandoning of unwholesome states and the acquiring of wholesome states. They are vigorous, energetic, and persevering with regard to wholesome states. When mind deliverance is still immature, Maggie, this is the fourth thing that leads to its maturity. Furthermore, Maggie, a practitioner, is wise, endowed with the Noble One's penetrative understanding of arising and passing away, leading to the complete ending of suffering. When mind deliverance is still immature, this is the fifth thing that leads to its maturity. So understanding impermanence, the arising and passing away, leading to the complete ending of suffering. When the mind deliverance is still immature, Maggie, these five things lead to its maturity. It is to be expected of a practitioner who has good friends, good associates, good companions, that they will be virtuous and that they will live restrained by the restraint of their discipline, endowed with good conduct and appropriate resort, and that seeing danger in the smallest faults, they will train in the training rules they have accepted. It is to be expected of a practitioner who has good friends that they will obtain at will, with no trouble or difficulty, talk that is effacing, a help in opening up the mind, talk about the knowledge and vision of deliverance. It is to be expected of a practitioner who has good friends that they will live with energy aroused, vigorous, energetic, and persevering in regard to wholesome states. It is to be expected of a practitioner who has good friends that they will be wise, endowed with the Noble One's penetrative understanding of arising and passing away, leading to the complete ending of suffering. So, clearly the Buddha's emphasis is on good friends here. And just to explore that a bit, what does that mean? You know, being a good friend to oneself, you know, what are the qualities of a good friend? What helps us stay upright? What allows us to relax into the body and not be captured by narratives of who we are, who we think others are. In a conversation I was having today with Will and Eliza, I mean, we have Dhamma friends, but we can just be with people who are kind, you know, just have kind associates, people that we go hiking with, or gardening club, or knitting club, or, you know, just people who have qualities that we can relate to and resonate with and be supported by. There was a story of when Longpo Sumedho was considering going to England to start, you know, to see if it would be possible to establish a monastery there. He talked with Ajahn Chah, and I think he expressed his reluctance in doing that. And Ajahn Chah said, "Aren't there any kind people in England?" Oh. You know. And so that was kind of the things that just kind of encouraged Longpo Sumedho to take the leap of going there. Yeah. Hmm. So then he continues on, the Buddha continues on, a practitioner, Meghiya, who is established in these five things should also cultivate four additional things. Reflections on the unlovely should be cultivated for overcoming lusts. Loving kindness should be cultivated for overcoming ill will. Mindfulness of breathing should be cultivated for cutting off discursive thinking. The perception of impermanence should be cultivated for the removal of the conceit, I am. For when one perceives impermanence, Meghiya, the perception of not self is established. When one perceives not self, one reaches the removal of the conceit, I am. This is called nibbana, here and now. Then on realizing its significance, the Buddha uttered on that occasion this inspired utterance. So this poem, trivial thoughts, subtle thoughts, mental habits that follow one along. Not understanding their mental thoughts, one runs back and forth with wandering mind. But having known these mental thoughts, the ardent and mindful one restrains them. An awakened one has entirely abandoned them, these mental habits that follow one along. So good friends towards self, towards others. I'm just reflecting on how in the early days when I would leave a retreat, it would be the integration would be very, very hard. And I think things have changed, and hopefully there's more sense of how we integrate back into the world. But I remember, I mean, I was pretty bullheaded, and I really practiced in a very intense way during retreats, and then I would want to hold on to the way of practicing regardless of the fact that the container was not there anymore. So, and then there would be a lot of dukkha as a result, you know, just because I'd be like trying to maintain mindfulness on the oncology ward. Yeah. It's insane. You know, and I just remember there was one time when I was trying to do it, and there was this big bin, a garbage bin by the nurse's station. I just kicked it. So here I am, you know, trying to be mindful and persistent, and I just was just like, man, you know, just so upset. So, yeah. And also just, you know, that there was a sense of heart was open during the retreat. Working on stuff and unfinished business, you know, and then coming home and just feeling like, oh wow, there's all this that still is not resolved, and there was a sort of sinking feeling, and I would not want you to experience that, and I don't feel like you need to, any of us need that, and so that's where it's really important to consider who you have as a Dhamma friend, you know, who you can talk to and just say, wow, you know, I've just been on a retreat and, you know, this is what's up for me. And like I say, maybe someone here, you know, if you find at the end of our time together on Wednesday there's a connection, maybe just take each other's emails down or phone numbers and be in touch with one another. Or just talk to a friend, you know, but don't feel that that it's just you, that you're in this isolated entity that has to manage this integration on your own. After a while, there came a time when on retreats, I would just, I remember there was one time, there was a very potent retreat, there was a lot of settling, and I just remember it was ending, and I just opened my hand, like, it's just gonna pass through, you know, it's over. Like, the container's over, whatever the results are will be revealed, and done, you know, just... if that makes sense, it's like, it's just sort of acknowledging that the container is over, that this is disbanding, this supportive way of practicing is coming to an end at this time, and then to just sort of shift into this sense of wondering what's changed, and wondering, a sense of curiosity, like, I know things have shifted based on this retreat. I don't know how it's going to manifest in my life. And so this sort of curiosity of, like, what's changed? How has this being going to experience life now? You know? And it felt like sometimes, like, I would try to be putting on a shirt that just didn't fit anymore. You know, so it was like I would try something, like maybe say something that I normally would say in a sort of maybe sarcastic way or something, but it just didn't fit. So it would be like, I would still do it, but then I would be like, oh, wow, that's just not, that doesn't feel good anymore. And then it would just go away. So be surprised at what at your way of experiencing your life. After retreats, Sharon Salzberg talks about this time when she was practicing metta early on extensively for maybe 6 weeks, maybe longer, and she was practicing with the phrases "May I be well," "May I be at ease," and she didn't feel like anything was changing for her. And then she was—I'm sure many of you know the story. Then she was walking down a flight of stairs, and she dropped a cup, and it broke. And she said something like, "Oh, you're such a klutz," which is something she would normally say, you know, just she would, the critical voice would come in, "And I love you," you know. So, and she was really surprised that that was a part of the verbal content that was coming through. So, So in Mehdi's case, he followed this delusion, you know, went into the mango grove, attempted to practice like he thought he could, and it didn't work. And so he went to the Buddha and he got a teaching. And in a sense, that's the practice. You know, we try something, and if it's skillful and it works, yes, good, keep doing it. If not, adjust it. So we have agency over how we practice. We have, in a sense, authority. And someone used that word in a note. And how we choose to practice and we see what the results are. I asked a monk a long time ago, if practice is leading to peace, is that a good barometer to continue to do, to practice that way? And he said, yes. So that's kind of a barometer for me. If it leads to peace, if it's for one's well-being of others. So good spiritual friends or good friends that have, that can help support you in that upright way of being, you know, sharing teachings. There's so many opportunities online. Being creative with how you use the online resources. We have a practice group that meets for morning puja once a week on Zoom. So we sit together and chant, do a reflection, and go to work. You know, so there's lots of options. You can be really, really creative. And I might want to just pause for a moment, see if there's anything left to share. I think that's it for tonight. I hope that was useful. And maybe we can just sit together for a few minutes.